Well, I want to begin this morning by pointing your attention to that first reading that we had from the book of 2 Timothy. This is the second of two letters that Paul wrote to one of his younger disciples, Timothy. It's a very personal letter offering encouragement and challenge to a young disciple of Christ. And it seems to me wherever we are on our spiritual journey, it's good to go back to those early days of our own journey of faith and learn from it. The passage starts with this word continue. It's translated in different ways. Continue in what you have learned. Stand by what you have learned. And Timothy, of course, will have recalled where he learned much of what he knew of his own faith. In fact, this particular epistle starts out by reminding him of the faith of his mother and his grandmother, who had such an important influence on him at the beginning of his own life. Remember that time, Paul is saying to Timothy, and remember who you learnt those truths from. Paul calls Timothy his son, which suggests a very intimate relationship between Paul as the older disciple and Timothy the younger. And just before these words that are printed for us in our sheet this morning, it says, "You, my son, have observed closely my teaching and manner of life, my resolution, my faithfulness, patience, and spirit of love." So we're brought very quickly in this passage to understand that Timothy lived in a community of faith with support from his family and from Paul. And many of us can look around in our own lives, whether they're present in this room or perhaps elsewhere, of people who've encouraged us, who gave us that opportunity to begin our journey of faith and who have supported us through it. And this passage is saying to all of us, remember that. Remember where you started. Remember the faith you were born into or that you learned and came to as you went on the journey of life. And stay in touch with those people who have been so faithful in helping and support you. The other thing that Paul asks him to remember in this passage is that from the very earliest days of his childhood, he has been familiar with the sacred scriptures. And Paul is saying, those sacred writings are God-breathed. They are inspired. They're alive with the Spirit of God. And when you read those sacred writings, you're having a personal audience with God because God is present in those words. They will make you wise. They will lead you to salvation. They are useful to teach and train you in right living. The Revised English Bible translates one of the verses here in this way: all inspired scripture, all writings that have the presence of God in them, has its use for teaching the truth and refuting error, or the reformation of manners and discipline in right living. And Timothy is charged in this passage, like all disciples, to pass on what he has learnt, not to just keep it for himself, but to share it with others, to patiently press it home in season and out of season, the passage says. For the time is coming, and I suggest it has certainly come in this generation, when people's minds will wander, and they will grow weary of sound teaching, following their own whim, and gathering a crowd of teachers to tickle their own fancy. That's another translation of this passage. We live in an era where there's a cacophony of voices clamoring to be heard. A cacophony is a harsh and discordant mixture of sounds. And I think all of us probably can identify with that as we move around in our world today. Sounds, noises that are conflicting with one another that it's very hard to make sense of, surrounding us and demanding our attention. I was talking to Chris Holliday, the mayor of Whitney, yesterday. And he was observing how much attention has been given to our forthcoming by-election on Thursday. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but Jeremy Corbyn was in town yesterday morning. Theresa May was in town yesterday afternoon. This is a pretty serious occasion. And I think every party thinks that the outcome of this election will be a marker in our understanding, our national mood, if you like, in terms of our attitudes. The Express headline said, "How many party leaders can you get in one constituency?" Well, that happened to us yesterday. And if you were wandering around in town yesterday, you will have noticed different representatives of different parties all clamoring for your attention, a discordant clamor of voices asking for our attention and loyalty. Well, the passage, as Jane read for us, contains this little phrase, people will be chasing after things that satisfy their itching ears. What's the cause of itching ears? Well, I've suggested from this pulpit before, and I repeat it because I think it's important. Most of us, in fact, I would say all of us, we live with what we might call second-hand minds. That is, the opinions we have, we didn't originate. We heard them from somebody else, they sounded good to us, and we took them on and pretended they're ours. And we've accumulated a whole lot of second-hand ideas. We put them together in some kind of meaningful story, and that's how we understand the world. Jacob Needleman, the American philosopher, talks about our minds as being a little bit like that second-hand shop, or perhaps the car boot sale out here on the field is a good example of other people's cast-offs. Our minds full of these different ideas, these different voices that clamor for our attention. Our itching ears are constantly looking for another little piece of information that might help us make a bit more sense of the world in which we live. And what's the cure for itching ears? Well, if we take Paul seriously, it means retaking possession of our own minds. And of course, our minds, like our bodies, need the proper nourishment. Go back to the source of wisdom and truth if you want to settle your mind on something that is meaningful, that will lead you to right living, as this passage says. Well, this leads me to the gospel that was read for us this morning in Luke chapter 18. And it's reporting, of course, the cries of a widow who's not receiving justice. All of us are familiar with the cries of widows today, their faces distorted by anger and pain and suffering is on our television screen every day of the week. Widows who are crying for justice and see none and see no hope and see no help and wonder if there will be any hope for them. Well, that's the situation of this widow. Widows at the time that Jesus was speaking were non-persons. To lose your husband is to lose the right to move around in a public space, to lose any claim on any property, to lose your voice. Widows had no rights whatsoever. Their life was dire. They would live from that moment onwards without any hope at all. And it's a widow who has the courage to break with the social taboos and try to get the attention of a judge whom she hopes will give some attention to her needs. Widows then and now seem to have no rights, no opportunity to really hear their own voice heard and the justice system to work on their behalf. The judge in this story is unscrupulous. It says he has no fear of God. He doesn't have any respect for anyone himself, except himself, it appears. And of course, he does his best to ignore this clamorous voice of the widow. It goes on for a time, and she keeps bothering him and interrupting him. Maybe, although she perhaps wasn't allowed out onto the street because she had to stay in her private space, maybe she could shout from the gate, trying to get the attention of this judge, to give some time to what she felt was a just cause. But she keeps wearing down this judge who refuses to listen to her. The Greek word in this translation actually can be better translated. When the judge finally came around and thought, well, she's such a bother, I'll get this case out of the way, what it says is that she was giving him a black eye. In other words, he was so irritated that he was concerned that this would draw attention to him and perhaps spoil his reputation. And so he finally gives in and he pays attention to this widow's case. Now, the gospel starts with this reading. Jesus told his disciples this parable about their need to pray always and not to lose heart. So the assumption is, and it says a little bit later, brings God into this, that perhaps if your prayer isn't answered at the beginning, just keep praying. There's, in other words, a challenge in this prayer for persistence. I don't know if you're familiar with the Shawshank Redemption, the film, but there's a prisoner in that film, Andy Dufresne, who is put in charge of the prison library. And every week he writes a letter to the state legislator asking for funds to buy books for the public library. After 6 years of writing every week with no response, he received several boxes of books and records and a check for $200 and a note that says, "Please stop sending letters to the legislator." What is Andy's response? He starts writing twice a week. Is this psalm a challenge to us to keep persisting in our prayers because God, the judge, will eventually hear and eventually he will grant what we want? Well, I don't feel comfortable with that sense of the meaning of this passage. Is that what we learn when we read this gospel as a part of the sacred writings, as a part of the scriptures? I think we have to look at the world in two different ways. There is a world, one that we rub up against all the time, full of these clamorous voices, and sadly, full of unjust, unkind, unthinking, unscrupulous people who don't give us the time of day and don't look after our needs, and where our only choice is courageous persistence. But there's another way of looking at our world. We can look at our world as God's world, and we can see that this world is not just a material and physical place, it is a spiritual place. The Bible talks about that as God's kingdom. That is the whole earth in the will of God. It's a spiritual kingdom. And we can learn all about that kingdom from the sacred writings, where God does grant justice to his people. See, all of us have petty judges in our minds. Part of that second-hand baggage that we carry around are voices that talk to us, that say, "No, you don't really deserve that, do you?" They contaminate our thoughts. They keep whispering in our ears, "You don't really rank in this situation, do you? You don't really deserve attention. Others should be ahead of you in the queue for justice. Don't expect to get what you deserve now." That's to see the world, to hear voices in our own heads of that material and physical world that we all experience from every day. And unfortunately, those voices scramble our GPS, our spiritual GPS. And the world becomes a kind of murky gray place where there's no clarity and no certainty and roads don't go anywhere. Prayer becomes a frustration in that kind of situation. We ask, but we get no answers. We become engulfed in an unspiritual mindset without hope. So what's the cure? Well, as Paul said to Timothy, go back to the sacred writings. Remember those early teachings that you received and the influence of God-fearing people on your life. The sacred writings are God-breathed. The Spirit of God lives within them, and to read them is to have a personal audience with God. They have spiritual power. In these writings, you will be reminded of God's way of doing things. You'll find the courage to squash those petty judges, those voices that are in your head that deprive you of your freedom and justice. And in reading those sacred writings, you'll learn to love again. Many years ago, long before the present conflict in Syria, but in the place where Aleppo now stands, the king of that region was at war with Israel. His best laid plans seemed to fail. It was as if the king of Israel knew in advance of exactly what his strategy was, and he was convinced there was a mole in his camp. And the king of Aram, as you can imagine, was frustrated and believed that he had somebody who was betraying his most inner secrets. But no one was. Someone came to him and said, "There's a prophet in Israel who knows exactly what you're thinking in the secrets of your own bedchamber. His name is Elisha." Well, furious at the thought that this person, right deep into his own soul and understand the deepest motivations of his own heart, he took his army of horses and chariots and tried to find this prophet, Elisha. He eventually traced him down to the town in which he was living, Dothan, and he surrounded the town overnight, So that when the assistant of Elisha the prophet woke the next morning, he looked up and he saw the armies of Syria, the armies of Aram, surrounding the town. And the assistant of Elisha went to Elisha and said, "What can we do? Where can we turn?" And Elisha prayed. And his prayer was that God would open the eyes of his assistant to see the spiritual forces that were aligned with God's purposes. And his eyes were opened, and he looked, and beyond the circle of the Syrian army, there was a host of angels, of horses and chariots there to defend Elisha. And Elisha said, "Don't be afraid. There are more on our side than are on theirs." If you want to read the way that story pans out, it's a fascinating story, just ripe for cinema, I think. But if you want to read it, it's in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 6. But the story, that story from the sacred writings, from the Holy Scriptures, has a meaning that's very clear to you and I. God is not slow to defend the widow and any who are in need, but we are blind. We have itchy ears. We listen to the wrong voices. And in our desperation, we concoct strategies that only make things worse. Much worse. The gospel ends with a question. God is not slow to answer the cries for justice, but we are slow to listen. And so, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Well, judging by the way we're behaving at the moment, the jury is out. Amen.